Alrighty. So, you guys, we're here with the Film Experience podcast again. This is Nathaniel, and I'm here with Murtada.
Hi, everyone.
And Nick.
Hey.
And I presume both of you are reeling, as I am, from just the onslaught of Critics Awards, which just wrapped up just before I called.
Were those today? I'm just kidding. Of course, yeah.
There were so many all at once, and it bled together even more than it should because everybody was Roma crazy. Like, every organization picked Roma for cinematography and best film.
But you were, like, doing the most. You were reporting about, like, the New Mexico film critics. Like, I was dealing with L.A. and Toronto and basically kept it at that.
Well, that New Mexico thing was possibly a mistake. I only tweeted out one thing, but I'm hearing that it's just one person who has their own critics on. I don't know if that's true, but it was very hard to find information about them.
I just went to the movies. I was like, I'll go see this movie, and when I come back, I'll know all the results.
Yeah, that was
smart. So you're saying that seeing movies is more important to you than knowing what other critics have voted about them?
Maybe. I don't know. I still followed.
You're so weird. Okay.
It's almost like you care about movies and not awards. What's wrong
I know, right?
You?
At this time of the year, it's all about the awards and the top tens.
Oh, the top tens. They're just relentless, and it is only December 9th as we speak.
I know, right? Like, I'm
still
never
seeing movies.
I'm never ready until, like, after the new year, as it should be.
Right.
I haven't posted mine from last year yet.
But the difference is we are actually, and all three of us are following along all year and going to movies all year.
That's true.
And going to the same festivals these other people go to. So how are they ready the first week of December?
I can't say. Also, I don't ask the screeners. I'm sure that helps other people. I don't know. Is that what happens?
I mean, Murtada and I get screeners, and we're still not ready.
Yeah. Besides, I mean, I don't get all the screeners. I just get the screeners that studios deem gay, because the only organization I'm a member of is the Gay Critics Organization.
What is the most surprising screener that's been considered gay that you've received?
I guess Crazy Rich Asians.
Wait, I wouldn't call that surprising.
Which was very funny because Warner Brothers sent us Crazy Rich Asians and A Star Is Born, but then everybody on the Facebook page for Galeka, the gay entertainment critics group, was saying, like, Warner Brothers have not sent a screener since J. Edgar.
Arguably less gay than either of those.
Yes. But, like, for instance, like, Philip here at home wanted to see Leave No Trace, but Bleecker Street decided to send me Colette and Disobedience, but not Leave No Trace, which is arguably their most successful awards movie. That's the one that's actually getting nominations.
And the bigger grosser than those others as well.
And it's not gay.
Well, Ben Foster steps out of a shower at one point, and it's only 2 seconds, but I certainly remember it.
I remember his hairy arms. So, Bleecker Street, if you're listening, send us Leave No Trace.
You guys, look, I have a special guest for the podcast.
Oh. Who is this? It's
this
a cat.
Is Christopher. It's a cat. He doesn't meow, though, or he would speak on the podcast.
He's very.
Are you going to do that thing where you have him, like, pick amongst your screeners, or was that a Monty specific?
That was Monty specific.
Okay.
So we should probably actually talk about something instead of just
how
riff.
Dare you.
So, Vox Lux, let's start there.
Everybody pick an accent.
Right. That's my question about the accents. It's like, Jude Law and Natalie have the accent, but the woman playing Natalie as a 14-year-old does not have the same accent. Well, she's playing the same character.
Fame not only changed her, it changed her vocal patterns.
Well, so, she does kind of sound like somebody putting on an accent.
That's true.
Like, I would buy that as a character point if that's how they were approaching it.
Well, there's nothing that's not artificial about Natalie Portman in the movie, and I don't mean that necessarily as a dig.
Yeah.
I would say it's a dig. Everything is so laborious. Even the walking. Even when she's like... like, nobody walks like that. It's like, what is happening, Natalie Portman? Like, okay, we know you're a movie star and there is a camera catching everything you're doing. But does it have to be so much work? Every gesture?
I mean, I have certainly felt that way about an abundance of Natalie Portman performances. And, like, there's no accounting for the fact that in this one, I kind of dug it. Like, I'm not ready to say, like, oh, everything's perfect or everything's even intentional, but I kind of liked watching her just freak out and let it all blow in the wind and, like, roll up her sleeves while walking every time she walks. I think there's always that, right? Like, you know, like, she's determined.
Yeah.
But yeah. Who are you walking?
In a way that I thought other performances that were equally strenuous were just bad.
Yeah, who knew walking took so much labor. I enjoyed it too, like, but not as like a real person or a real character.
Yeah.
But just enjoying so many things happening on screen.
But is there anything about the movie that's supposed to reflect realism? Because I did not get that from that movie. Although, I can't really say what I did get from it. I'm eager to hear from Nick because I did not get what Brady was going for. It just seemed like it reminded me, even though it's nothing like it, of Adam McKay movies.
Oh, whoa.
Right. In that, like, Brady's like the art film division of this, where it's like, I'm just going to throw every idea I have at the screen. Some of it'll work. Let's hope it all works as a whole. Like, that sort of approach where it's just like a shotgun, and like, you're going to hit something.
Maybe gun metaphors are not super appealing in this context, Nathaniel.
Well, in both of the movies, people get shot.
Yeah. Oh, and Vice. Oh, right. Got it. Okay. Okay. I'm keeping up. I'm doing really well.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, like, I do think it's a super aggressive movie, and I took it as, like, a series of kind of obnoxious propositions to which you can imagine responding any number of ways, anybody. I guess, like, I'm not trying to, like, be obnoxious back at you. This is, like, an actual comment. Like, I took it the way you have often told me you take Uma Thurman's performances, where it's just like, I'm going to do a thing and see how it goes over with everybody. But that didn't feel, and some people are going to like it and some people definitely are not, but it didn't strike me as like anything goes in the way that, like, I haven't seen this yet, but like...
No, I mean just Adam McKay in general, because The Big Short was that way too.
Yeah. But The Big Short did seem like a whole bunch of shit pretty scattershot. And I thought Vox Lux kind of had a strategy in place, but just a sort of brash one. What did you think, Murtada?
I mean, I certainly think he's a good director because he's like, you know, he sets it up so well. Like, I was never bored and I was engaged. There was always something on screen engaging me, whether it's Natalie going over the top, whether it's just the way that he shoots the scenes. But I don't know, like, what were his ideas about this? Is besides, you know, pop is bad. What's the link between, you know, the movie does start with a huge terrorist act. So that sets up the whole story. That's how she becomes why she becomes a pop star. And is he saying, what is he saying? What's the link between pop stardom and terrorism that he wanted to make? I don't think that was clear to me.
Nor to me. Like, I found people's writing about it I was bored. I hate to use that word, but I was. But I will say this, like, I found people writing about it really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one of those movies that has an appeal after the fact, but I did not find watching it interesting. I just felt the obnoxious thing you're talking about.
Yeah.
I also had a problem with the songs. They were so forgettable and banal.
But I think they were supposed to be. But again, where I'm lost as to what the actual message is.
I get they're supposed to be, obviously, because his whole point is pop is bad. But how is she this massive star if this is what she's singing? Nobody's going to buy those songs. And nobody's going to buy the concert where she, like, goes 2 to the left, 3 to the right, and raises her hand. What are these amateur dance moves? These are not pop star moves. Like, this is not somebody who's a massive star. Not the tunes, nor the dancing moves tell me this is a massive star. They tell me she's a bad pop star, which I guess is the point he's making. But there's a disconnect in that she's this massive star. How did she become this massive star?
Perhaps Jackson Maine would like this movie.
Maybe.
Would rather die than watch the... Also, not a great metaphor. This is like everything horrifying to him, isn't it?
Yeah. So they would make an interesting double feature, A Star Is Born and Vox Lux.
I on purpose saw them back to back for that reason at TIFF, even though I didn't really know what I was getting. But I don't know. I don't actually. I mean, we just disagree about this, I guess. But I didn't think that he thought pop was, or that the movie thinks pop is bad.
But what was your takeaway from it? Like, I'll admit that I've forgotten a lot of it, other than the sort of fable-like narration and the bifurcation of the whole thing about, like, youth and then,
mm-hmm.
you know, recast everybody for, like, many years later. Natalie Portman going very big, which I found enjoyable even if it didn't always work.
I mean,
but
this
I don't remember a takeaway from it. I should have written something at the time, because now it's kind of like a blur for me.
I do want to say something about the pop is bad thing. So this is a spoiler. You know, fast forward 30 seconds if you don't want to hear it. But the narration actually tells us she made a pact with the devil to stay alive and become a pop star. So doesn't that tell us pop is bad?
I mean, that narration is so sort of like weirdly facetious at times too, though. I mean, like I'm not denying that there's some truth in that, but I also don't even know if the movie thinks the devil is bad, really, you know?
Okay, like, probably.
I mean, I guess if that you're asking about a takeaway, Nathaniel, and I guess I felt like this movie was interested in a moment where, like, global exposure and celebrity is the payment you get for almost anything, even things you have, like, that make no sense to respond to that way. So, like, she's in this disgusting scenario, and this is what she's rewarded with. And then you expect people to handle that, and she can't, or doesn't, but that I also appreciated that the movie wasn't sort of, at the same time, I think the movie presents her as, you know, she's not just somebody that we pity. Like, this is not a great, this is not a person that I loved. Even though I didn't think the movie thought the pop was bad or that she was necessarily bad, I did think that there was a kind of open argument about whether celebrity had made her obnoxious or whether she might always have been, and like the Wheel of Fortune hit her to be famous. I thought there were all these kind of assertions around her possibilities that are really hard to resolve. And then it just hands you this 20-minute concert performance and asks you to see anything in it that you want to, or that you could, you know, defend.
So you liked how sort of open it was then?
Yeah, I felt like that block of performance at the end is like a Rorschach the movie serves to you at the end and like invites you to apply anything you think you've gotten from what's happened up until that point to that. And like, yeah, I would agree that it seemed kind of mediocre to me, but also kind of all in. And I don't know, are there not pop stars who are that mediocre who are like, who become famous because of the stuff they say, or the manner they have more than like their talent? Like that, I see what you're saying about that, but it didn't seem totally beyond the ken either.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely interesting to hear people's takes on it, probably for the Rorschach effect that you're mentioning.
Yeah.
Because it is an eccentric movie.
Yeah.
And those, even if they're not as open-ended as this one, they tend to provoke that sort of disparate effect of what people even think things are about.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting movie to read about and interesting to hear what anybody thinks of it. So if you have seen it, we would love to hear.
Guys, do you want to know who I sat next to at the screening? Somebody in the awards race, which was more fascinating to me than the movie. It's Boots Riley.
Interesting.
That's kind of great, because those are the two kind of like most balls out movies I think I've seen all year. Like,
and then it was so funny, like, afterwards, after the movie, the screening ended, to go on his Twitter and find that he actually tweeted about it. So everybody go to Boots Riley's Twitter, find out what he thought of Vox Lux.
I know Carrie Preston loved Natalie Portman in it because she tweeted that.
I don't know what anybody who's not me thought about it. Sorry. Except my colleague who I work with, who, like, I wouldn't say he got mad at me, but he needed to be mad at somebody about how much he hated it, and I was the only other person who'd seen it, and so I was his repository for all of his bad feelings. Mm. You liked that? Like it? Like, what can I tell you?
Well, I did sit next to you during Vox Lux at the festival, and I was noting from the corner of my eye that you took copious notes. So
that all culminated in the sentence, not yet reviewed in full. As always.
I thought those notes would be like a huge review in and of itself, like a 1,000-word review.
At some point, I should just start scanning those and posting them, and that'll just be my archive.
So,
but I am really excited to see it again, and there are a lot of movies that I, you know, maybe even some that I liked at least as much, that I'm not as interested to test a second time.
So, Nick, you famously love Pieces of April.
Oh my god, why are you this way? Why would you even say something like that?
Well, I bring it up because Peter Hedges is back.
Oh my god.
With Ben is back. But it has Julia Roberts in it. And you love her. So are you excited to see it? Murtado and I have both seen it, but are you going to see it?
I am definitely going to see it. I will grip my armrests. And hope for the best.
It definitely looks better than Pieces of April.
Nothing could have been more obvious. I mean, it goes without saying.
One we are hope. Thankfully past that era in filmmaking where
everyone
thought it would be cool to try digital before digital was ready for prime time.
And Julia's so good in it. I loved her so much in Ben is Back.
She's very good in it. The movie's a bit slight. We can discuss later, because it's only in something like 4 theaters.
Yes, maybe we can discuss next week. I just want to say one thing, because Nick, before we started recording, we were talking about Julia, and you mentioned Kate Blanchett, which is so funny to me, because when I was watching Ben is Back, I thought of Kate Blanchett. Not because Julia reminds me of Kate Blanchett, but this is the kind of part that Kate plays. You know, those women who are on the verge of unraveling and crumbling at any moment, and you're just holding on by this tiny thread. Mm. So Julia does it fantastic too, so who knew?
That's cool.
Well, I will say this about Julia. I did not see this new act of her career coming. When she was at her superstar phase, I never pictured her as somebody who would age well into, like, mother roles.
Mm.
And I think she's really good at mother roles. Like, I thought she was great in Wonder last year.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she really sells the relationship with kids in both movies. So I'm impressed. Because she seemed a little, shall we say, narcissistic as a film star in her early years. Like, sometimes it didn't feel like other actors were in the frame.
It's just so
wow.
much... So much light came out of her. The screen loved her so much. That's why we thought that.
Possibly.
Sometimes her co-star was like Nolte, or... or she was stuck in Mary Riley. I mean, what was she supposed to do?
Yeah.
Well, at any rate, I think she's really good, and Ben is back, too.
I think, Nathaniel, I know you said, you know, SAG is coming. I think this might be the surprise SAG Best Actress nomination. Because she's amazing, and I think they did a lot of SAG screenings. Mm.
It's possible. Anything's possible, though, as Naomi Watts and St. Vincent remind us. Anything with Screen Actors Guild is possible.
Or Gwen Verdon in Marvin's Room. That's what I'm here for.
Or Helen Mirren at... No, I'm just kidding.
Helen Mirren did happen at SAG so many times.
Oh, goodness.
She does have a movie this year, Winchester.
Oh, my God. It's true. Damn you, Murtada. Now you've put the fear in me until Wednesday.
She's coming.
That would be amazing. Is that when the nominations are, Wednesday?
Yeah. So, let's talk about Los Angeles Film Critics.
Yes, much like Vox Lux, you have like avoided standard narrative structure. That's where I thought we were starting. You brought it up, and then we went. We're back. Okay.
We are. So, what do you guys make of the rule that some critics groups have that if you win foreign film, you cannot win best film?
My favorite version of it, which I mistakenly thought the LA critics also did, but they don't, is what the National Society of Film Critics does, where if a non-English language movie wins Best Picture, they just cancel foreign film. Because then you don't have this confusing-ass situation where Roma is the best movie of the year, but Shoplifters and Burning are tied for the best foreign language film. Like, you know, I mean, it's great for those three movies to all get recognition. I'm all for that, which is, you know, really the most important thing about these awards anyway. But that's how
yeah. I agree with you. It doesn't make sense. Like, it doesn't make sense. So, yeah, they're all not in English. I would say just do away with foreign language and best film. If you're critics, not for the Oscars, because we know we need as many non-English language films as we can get. But if you're a critics group, just have best film. And maybe it would be something not in English.
Yeah. Or a documentary, even.
Or just, I know some groups do this. Well, not critics groups, but like Golden Globes, where if you're not in, where if you are foreign language, you're not eligible for Best Picture. Because you have your own Best Picture.
Which I also think is stupid.
Okay.
But isn't that for the Globes specifically because they're the Hollywood Foreign Press and they're trying to stop people from lobbying for, I don't know what the history of that decision is, but what does that mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, best film can only be in English. That doesn't make any sense.
Which is the craziest thing in the world for a group of foreign members of the press. I'm using foreign in quotes here. To imply.
Right. Yes. Perhaps there is no perfect way to give out awards. Except for your own awards. Like the New Mexico Film Critics.
But you know what? Like, I love Burning and Shoplifters, and I like Roma very much, so I'm happy for all those three movies. Like, they all now get, like, a stamp. L.A. Film Critics Best Film, hopefully, which is great for those movies, because at least two of them are still in theaters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, like, for especially, I mean, like, this is a point, Nathaniel, you've made many times about the Oscars, principally, about the inattention to Asian cinema.
Right.
And Asian American cinema as well. And if you combine those and see how LA got behind Shirkers and Minding the Gap and Burning,
yeah,
and
it was a big year for Asian cinema with LA Film Critics.
Would that that could have spread to Sakura Ando, but I guess you can't have everything. That's already a lot to have.
I know, right? Sakura. Who's going to give her the award? We have to give her a special award from the three of us.
But yeah, I liked their picks overall. The Deborah Gronick thing was exciting.
Yes. I mean, and I don't understand why more people, I mean, the argument I get back whenever I state this, you know, people get very upset with me about it, but whenever I say I like some variety, is they're like, no, you're supposed to vote for what's best. And I'm like, it's just not realistic that everyone in the world thinks the same thing is the best. So I think it's rubber stamping of other people's choices, because you especially see it with the really large critics groups. I mean, not large, but the really influential ones. If I had all the time in the world to research this, I would. But I've noticed over the years that as soon as critics groups that announce after either New York or L.A. often pick things that were surprises at New York and L.A.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they came from out of the blue. Like, nobody expected that to happen. And then suddenly everybody's like, yeah, that's great. So that's what I'm talking about. And it's not that it's bad. It's good that good films are getting attention and that they don't always, like, rubber stamp the very obvious. But there's really no point in having 43 groups or whatever it is now, if everybody's just agreeing with each other.
Mm. But isn't it more about compromise? Like, let's say, you know, you're a critic, you walk into LA today with Sakura Ando as your vote for best actress, and then she gets eliminated first round, right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not. But at the end, you're left with Olivia Colman versus Toni Collette, and you like Olivia more. Olivia is in the Oscar race. She is somebody who's won other critics' awards, but you prefer her over Tony, so that's your vote between those two.
Well, that's part of it too. Those two things combine create a lack of diversity, which I think is a problem because there's no point in 43 awards if only, you know, a group of five things win them.
I mean, I would argue there's not any point to there being 43 awards. I would just, from my perspective, I would just stop there. Seriously, I mean, you're never going to not get, like, all kinds of trending across that many groups. And,
that's
like,
true.
I think, I totally understand why the two coasts don't or shouldn't mean everything. But if this were a case where you were constantly getting, like, genuinely different winners, maybe that would be something else. But it's never like, oh, this is something that resonated in the South in a way it didn't in the rest of the country. Or this, you know, it's just the same stuff. So,
yeah. Any other feelings about this?
I mean, yeah, I would put, you know, Nick already mentioned her, but I love the Deborah Granik Best Director, because that was a great vote. It's a great film, and it's nice to see, to your point, Nathaniel, something different, that it's not Cuarón, who has won every other award, basically, from all critics. So that was a nice mention.
I'm a little bit stymied, because I don't know either of your opinions about this performance, but I thought Ethan Hawke was fine to good in First Reformed, but he's, like, not close to my favorite performance of the year, and I can see where he would be, like, for any number of other people, but do you guys love that performance?
I do, but, and this is, again, to my point of a variety of choices as best, in quotes. I rarely feel that anyone in any year is so much better than everyone else that there's not room for disagreement. And so that's why I object to somebody like sweeping, because it's just, it's not, like, whenever I choose somebody as my best or my gold medalist, and people say, I can't believe you didn't choose this person or whatever, I'm like, I like them just a hair better than all these other people, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what always confuses me about one person dominating like that, because I don't know how you have a situation where nobody thinks Bradley Cooper is best all of a sudden, because I think that performance is kind of a miracle, especially because it's unlike his other performances, and he directed it also. So it seems to me like a major acting achievement, and, you know, people just don't feel like recognizing it for whatever reason.
I love Ethan Hawke, too. I thought he was great, and I love that performance since I saw the movie last year. But yeah, I would probably vote for Bradley Cooper, too. And I'm surprised that he hasn't even won any regional critics. Because I know we talked about this earlier when we talked about Best Actor Nathaniel, and somebody was like, oh, I think it was Chris who said Bradley Cooper would win some critics awards, and I was like, he's not going to win New York and LA, but he'll probably win some regional critics. But no, he hasn't won anything.
Yeah, it's Ethan Hawke across the board.
Which is surprising.
Yeah.
But, you know, A Star is Born made $200 million. It's going to win at least a few Oscars. So I get, like, people, you know, if critics are taking this as advocacy as opposed to, you know, obviously, but it's a performance they love, but they also want to advocate for something, then I understand why Ethan Hawke is sweeping, because that's the performance that they want to get all the accolades that they really love.
But if it's advocacy, this is my question every year also, if it's advocacy, why does everybody feel the need to say what everybody else said? Because if it's really about advocacy, wouldn't you feel like, oh, this other major influential group already said that, so that's, you know, they did it for us, we can highlight something else that's just as good.
Yeah, the kid from Capernaum.
Nick, you're...
For example.
He's amazing in that movie.
Yeah.
Zayn Rafia is his name.
I think I'm kind of where Murtada is, that, like... Mm-hmm. You know, there could be a lot of people who like Ethan Hawke that much, just that much more than they like other folks. And mm-hmm. anytime you get 20 people together to vote for best pizza, you're going to get pepperoni or cheese. You know, like it is like it is something about consensus, you know.
Yeah.
And it's why I always like it when the critics groups like release their runners up.
Yeah.
I think the National Society is the only one that pretty consistently goes even beyond just one runner-up, and mm-hmm. that's where you start getting, like, the Cynthia Nixons and the things that, you know, turned out. And L.A., I thought, had really interesting runners-up today
yeah.
in a lot of categories. But you're not going to get that. It's the same way that we often talk about, you know, having more fun on nomination day anyway than, like, when the winners are announced, right? So
yeah.
I don't think it's that. You know, it can get a little bit tedious when the same person's winning all the time, but again, I put that more on the number of people all having parallel votes than mm-hmm. than the fact it's the same stuff coming up on top.
Or that a lot of critics actually are in more than one critics group.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
The runner-up thing, Nick, today was amazing for Elizabeth Debicki. Like, that's a great performance. Mm-hmm. Like, I totally would, like, if
but...
we got to Regina versus Elizabeth, neither of them are my number one best supporting actress of the year. But if we got to those two, even though I love Debicki, I'll probably vote for Regina King. So I get why she won.
See, I feel differently about it. And this is what I was talking about with advocacy. Because even though of those two performances, which are both totally amazing, I like Debicki a little bit better. But at this point, if Debicki had been sweeping the way Regina is, I would totally vote for Regina. So this is what I'm talking about with advocacy and, like, you know, there the difference when two people are completely inspired and great, the difference between how high quality they are just seems to me razor thin. So that's why I guess I'm just asking why people don't have more the impulse of like spreading the wealth. I guess that's what I'm asking, rather than, you know, is it advocacy?
Well, I mean, I'm not in any of these groups, so it's hard for me to conjecture, but I feel like they, and I'm sure different members of them feel differently, mm-hmm. But I can imagine that what you're advocating for is the evening that you're trying to create with your critics groups and your winners, you know, like mm-hmm. if you're really hoping that you'll have the chance to say to Regina King how much her performance moved you or how much her career has been inspiring for a long time, and mm-hmm. this feels like it culminates that. Like, you know, it's different if you're advocating for what you want your group to put its stamp on than if you're trying to advocate for people in a larger conversation leading up to other award shows.
Yeah, that's true.
And I don't think the groups are unaware of their role in that, you know, but at all. But it's not necessarily going to trump, like, other reasons you vote for. Hmm. Other reasons.
I can see that.
Can I be a Harridan, though, and go back to Ethan Hawke for a second? Mm-hmm. Like, and this is not out of, like, petulance, but I'm just curious, like, since this is the point of the award cycle, too, where the discourse has mostly become about who's ahead and who's behind. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious what you felt like he did with that role that was his, like, distinctive approach to that role from what was on the page. Because that was where I kind of stopped with him. Like, I liked the performance, but so much was about being the placeholder for that character as written. Mm. But what is it about the performance, I'm just curious, that is so galvanizing to you?
And here is where I wish I had seen it recently instead of a long time ago. Because I'm not sure I have an answer. This is why I also like to get screeners, because before I do make my final votes on anything, I always rewatch stuff. Not necessarily all the way through, but like to remind myself.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I have an answer off the top of my head. That's what I need SmackDowns for, to revisit and really think about the performances.
I mean, I don't think I have an answer to what he did versus what was on the page, but I think it's about a feeling, right? He, to me, encompassed that feeling of, like, helplessness and rage at the same time that sometimes drives people a little crazy.
Mm.
And especially when you know so much and you're trying to change things, but you can change them. And I just felt like while I was watching him, like, I clearly understood the character and what he was trying to do at every point in that movie. And that's mm-hmm. why I love the performance, because it was always clear to me, no matter what was happening in the scene, what the character of the priest was feeling.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I love the performance. Yeah. I don't know if that answers your question or not.
Yeah, sure.
Now that you've said that, I'm thinking back to a couple choices, and I did like the overall feeling of impotence about the performance, like that he never struck me as someone who believed that he would ever be able to accomplish any of the things he was trying to accomplish in any scene.
Hmm.
Which I thought was really interesting, and which, now that Murtada, thanks for jogging my memory about the performance, but like that's what I thought was interesting about, because the movie has, like, not no spoilers if you haven't seen it yet, but it has a very sort of shocking ending.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what sold the ending for me, is all that buildup of feeling this undercurrent of every scene, like it was all hopeless for him.
Mm-hmm.
Even though he was performing everything he was supposed to perform, like trying to counsel his parishioners and doing his, you know, medicine or whatever for his illness. But of course, even that he was fucking up, and sometimes purposely.
Yeah.
So, I think it was that feeling of hopelessness and impotency that really got me. But I will say with Bradley Cooper, the reason that I'm so I have seen the movie 3 times and quite recently, so it's much easier for me to understand why I love that performance so much. But I just think it's he's fully absorbed everything. Every direction you could think about the character feels fully absorbed to me. Like, the fact that I was talking to a friend and they were complaining about, like, well, the movie doesn't do anything with his hearing loss, for example. Like, that it was...
You need to cut that friend.
No, that their point was, like, it's brought up like it's so important, but then in the end, that plot line doesn't become something. Exactly.
He wanted him to lose his hearing? Like, the guy...
I'm just saying, this was brought up to me as a complaint about the movie. But to me, it didn't matter that didn't go anywhere in a plot sense. Because to me, that was fully absorbed in everything about the performance. Like, I just was so shocked how thorough the performance was. Mm-hmm. You know, people love to say lived in about performances they love, but that is a classic example of what that adjective means about a performance. Like, even in scenes that had nothing at all to do with music, I could feel the way he was having trouble with his ears based on head tilts, based on body. Like, I felt it was just, everything was so thorough. I was so impressed with that. So, yeah, he would be my vote.
Mm-hmm.
I just gave away. Bradley Cooper is my favorite actor of the year. I think everybody knew this already. It's not a spoiler.
I think you're not alone. I think it's a lot of people's favorite performance.
Well, we'll see.
But that's just because they haven't seen Zayn Al Rafia.
I know, right?
Now they're going to be up for the same parts.
For sure.
So
he's
for
moving...
those of you who are like, who is Zayn Al Rafia? Next weekend, there's a movie coming out, Lebanon's Oscar submission, Capernaum, which we've all seen. And I believe all three of us are completely floored by Zayn Al Rafia, who plays the leading character, who is also named Zayn.
Yes. I saw this movie this afternoon. I'm still reeling from it. It's just, it is relentless and too much to take. And I mean that as a compliment. Like, it's too much, but I welcomed every bit of it.
For those who don't know anything about it yet, it's a look at the refugee crisis in Lebanon, and they have all these people living on the streets and no social programs really that are making life livable for refugees. So it's about this little kid who's sort of just trying to live on the streets, who leaves his family because... Well, I'm not going to spoil that part of why he leaves his family, but he leaves his family and trying to make it on his own, and he's like 11 years old or something. So it's pretty brutal, but I thought it was very exciting filmmaking, and I was kind of shocked by how good the performances were, because it was all non-actors. And I thought everybody was great in it, even like the tiny part.
And even the tiny people, that little baby, Jesus.
I mean, this movie, the two main characters are a 12-year-old and a toddler, and they give two of the best performances of the year. So just how did Nadine Labaki coax those performances? How did she set the scene? How did she get them to do this? Like, it's amazing.
Yeah. So speaking of people who aren't getting best director prizes.
Yeah. Or editing, you know, since I'm sure that was a high task, constructing those performances as though she had coaxed them.
So what do you guys make of the most common complaint I've heard about this movie from people who don't like it is that it's exploitative and poverty porn. I assume you guys have heard this complaint about it.
But I mean, those things exist, right? I mean, to what I said earlier, the movie is relentless, but these characters who live at the margins exist. Sometimes they're shown to us in a very sort of humanist, nice way. Not nice, you know, some other adjective, like Koreeda does in Shoplifters. And sometimes their circumstances are shown to us in this sort of relentless bad to worse to just the worst that that happens in Capernaum. So it didn't really bother me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I didn't feel like the movie was overconfident of either knowing who its audience was. Like, I didn't think that it was all aimed at an audience that had no context for this movie. Like, it felt like a movie you might make for a Lebanese audience, potentially.
Yeah.
And so it didn't seem to have a kind of, like, you know, in the way that Slumdog is so, like, let's do it for the people out here in the UK. You know, like let me show you what India is really like. And in a way that I could not imagine that that is what you would show an audience in India. And it didn't, in the same way, it just didn't feel like it was there to, like, teach me information or tell me the right way to think about stuff. I mean, I'm kind of, you know, I feel a bit humble about responding to those critiques because I'm not the person who would be best positioned to adjudicate them.
Right.
But I didn't feel like it thought that rubbing our noses in characters' bad experiences was educational for us, or it didn't do the things that movies that do trigger me that way have done.
Yeah. I feel the same way. I did not feel it was exploitive, but I'm not Lebanese, or a Syrian, or a refugee.
Spoilers!
So it's possible that I have, like, a Western perspective on it that I'm not aware of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as someone who grew up in, you know, in Sudan, speaking Arabic, watching movies in Arabic, most of them Egyptian, like, this sort of like melodrama heightened emotion, sort of like things that are really, really bad happen to characters. That's like the bread of butter and butter of movies coming from that region. So mm-hmm. I thought, personally, if I compared this to movies that I grew up with and loved, I would say it was restrained. Mm-hmm. A little bit,
mm-hmm.
and actually not as much as other things I've seen. So,
yeah,
that's a perspective.
It is, and you speak Arabic, so you don't always need the subtitles like the rest of us do.
Yeah, I would say about, you know, watching a movie in Arabic, that kid was so filthy. Like, I was, like, listening to him and also reading the subtitles. Every second word out of his mouth was cunt or fuck, and they were not all translated.
Oh, my.
Especially when he talks to his dad, they were both so filthy.
Sounds like Sony Pictures Classics intervened there a little bit.
Wow, that is interesting to know. Because he already felt very adult to me, and not—I don't necessarily mean that as a compliment. Because obviously, he was a kid without a childhood, which is terribly sad. But knowing that, it's even more wow. Okay.
Yeah, it's very realistic, right? I mean, that's the language he's hearing all the time in the streets with his parents. So yeah.
Yeah.
So not to, like, divert us to a conversation we've had before and that we will probably have again at a more appropriate time, but, like, there are just so many non-English language movies representing their countries in the Oscar race this year that in any other year would seem like they would obviously win. And right. So I'm so curious how that's all going to shake out.
I am, too. I think the finalist list, which bugs me that it's only 9 every year, because I don't understand why it isn't 15, like documentary, but... I just can't imagine, like, how will the executive committee even know what movies to save, so to speak?
Right.
Because they get 2, right?
They get 3.
Oh, 3. And there's so many wildly acclaimed foreign films this year that it's like, okay.
I would assume this is not one that they would have to swoop in on, but yeah. I'm making this up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I saw it at MoMo, their contender series this afternoon, and just based on the reaction in that room of, like, the wild applause and, like, everything mm-hmm. that happened, I would say probably not.
Yeah. I mean, I did think it was pretty terrific, but But I've really only disliked one of the contenders I've seen so far in that category. And even that, I was kind of with for the first half, and then I was like, oh, I don't know about this, which was Girl from Belgium. Like, I kind of was in it for the first half, but it just got more and more like, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I hated the ending.
I think everybody who sees it will hate the ending, unless you're just, like, clueless.
Yeah, well, I mean, it just, but it, obviously, a lot of people love it, because it, you know, gets nominated for things, and which I don't, so that's the one I don't really get of one of the ones that I think will probably be in the finalist list.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only one I'm sort of don't want to be in the finalist list. Because
I mean, I worry that we might get it. Like, I mean, I hate that movie, but like, I'm not, the way that the movie keeps using like its score and its photography to purport to be sympathizing with this character or feeling sad about what's happening to this character while mm-hmm. putting this character through these completely gruesome things that I'm stunned a movie would put a character through like that. Like, mm-hmm. it is such a, like, feeding people the most sensationalist things they might want to imagine. Because unlike Capernaum, I do not believe anybody would make this movie for a trans viewer firmly in mind. But
mm-hmm.
So, like, feeding them sensationalist hyperbole of an increasingly gross sort while pretending to perform liberal sympathy. I feel like we've seen that over and over and over again. Like, I'm not confused why it's nominated. I'm just disappointed.
Yeah.
My sort of prediction for the foreign language is Never Look Away. Because that movie, like, is about all the big important themes of the 20th century, and then it has a scene at the end where basically there's a Q&A, and they explain the themes of the movie. So not only do you get to feel important, but you get to feel smart, and you don't even have to think. So
it's like how they put those discussion questions at the ends of books now.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
What did you think the character was thinking?
So, I really think this movie will be nominated, and maybe like 5 years ago, it would have definitely won.
Mm. I mean, I think that about so many of the things. Like, I think Capernaum could have won in other years. I think Cold War could have won easily in other years. Shoplifters.
I think Capernaum could still win.
Yeah, so I mean, but basically, like, one of these things that could win is going to get left out.
Mm-hmm.
Which is crazy. Because I'm also, you know, because I talk to a lot of publicists about this category because they know we cover this category. So I hear things, and you can't trust everything that publicists say, of course, but you hear things through the grapevine. And there's a lot of movies that are getting good responses, you know, like
mm-hmm.
Birds of Passage is another mm-hmm. one that might show up. And, you know, he's been nominated before for Embrace of the Serpent, that director, Ciro Gara. And, you know, even though people seem to love Happy as Lazzaro, which was not selected by Italy, apparently people also love Dog Man, which was...
Yeah, they do.
And then, Murtada, you thought The Guilty was really involving, right?
Yes, The Guilty is very good. But, like, I would say The Guilty, if you look at these movies, Shoplifters, Capernaum, Roma, Never Look Away, like, just The Guilty seems a little smaller in theme. Like, it's a very good movie, but the theme, you know, all these other movies are taking on so much
yeah.
of the big sort of ideas that The Guilty will, in comparison, not feel as worthy. But it is.
So that could help it with, you know, there's almost always at least one movie like that gets included, right?
That does what?
Could nominate 4 months and 3 weeks, but why not just nominate After the Wedding, you know?
Oh, I will never get over that 4 months and 3 weeks thing, but I will give that movie this. It probably saved us in the long run, because once they've changed the voting systems because of all those
yeah.
terrible decisions, the category's been great almost totally. Ever since.
Totally.
Yeah. Although I keep reading these articles that says this year something has changed, but I can't really, nobody seems to know how to explain it in article form. So I don't know what has changed in the voting this year, but does that, Nathaniel, you're somebody who sort of like follows the, so does that mean we're in for some surprises because the voting has changed this year? Did they open it up?
I did not hear that it had changed.
Maybe it just means the winner will be announced via tweet during a commercial break in the telecast.
I mean, don't quote me on this, but I think it used to be only people in LA who could vote, and now it's open to others, and there might be a couple of other changes. There was this article on Deadline, and I got so confused after reading it, but that's what I got.
So that would be bad journalism if it didn't make any sense reading it.
It didn't make any sense. I know there are changes. That's why. I was like, what is this article saying?
Well, it used to be, I mean, one thing I do believe has changed is that you aren't assigned specific movies anymore, I don't believe, whereas it used to be, even very recently, it used to be that they would divvy up, you know, since there's 80 plus every year, that they would divvy it up into like three or four groups who would have to watch a bunch to be on the main nominating committee. But now, or watch a certain percentage of the movies within their tier, you know, within that 30 movies or whatever. And I think now it's more of like a free-for-all, I think, about people voting, like, you know, not necessarily assigned movies. So that's why it's a little more important to have a higher profile, because more people are going to show up. You know,
to see that movie
that might be more inclined to vote for it because they're showing up because they want to see it.
Mm-hmm.
But I would have to look into that, because it is confusing how often they change the rules.
Yeah.
But
all right. I'm sorry, I just decided we were wrapping up. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
Nick
it's okay.
is ready to go, people.
Bye. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like we're just all over the place. I'm sorry. But I did want to... Murtada, you had a great idea for discussion this week about how important narrative is, and like why are people skeptical of the Glenn Close narrative, and yet all on board the Amy Adams narrative when they're essentially the same narrative.
Yeah, I'm surprised, because that's all I see on Twitter. Like, people are not believing Glenn Close can write her narrative to a win, while everybody sort of just threw the towel, like, Amy Adams is winning supporting actress, where...
Yeah. I mean, I've noticed that too, but I don't actually think Amy Adams is going to win. I think Regina King's going to take it all. You know, sometimes we have things where we're critical darlings. Like, as soon as the televised awards start, they stop winning, like Laurie Metcalf last year.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I think Regina King is one of those crossover appeal stars where the televised awards are going to be just as into Regina King. I mean, she's already an awards magnet on television, just like Allison Janney was.
Yeah.
So I think Regina King is going to take the Oscar.
She's so popular.
Yeah, she's so popular, and I hate to predict wins before nominations, but I don't see a scenario where people aren't going to be excited about Regina King.
Yeah. Also, I just think people are going to love Beale Street more than Vice, and that might be the only category where you can maybe music that would be Regina King would be the only way you can sort of, you know, reward this movie that I think a lot of people, me included, love so much and want to reward, which I understand why she's sweeping critics. Because if you love that movie and you're in the critics group and you're, or in the Academy, and you're faced with all these other options and you're choosing other things, or other things are rising to the top, and you come to supporting actress and there's Regina and the movie you love.
I thought the same thing about Laurie Metcalf. First Nathaniel was like, Pieces of April, and then he's like, Laurie Metcalf lost. That's why I want to go, because you keep treating me this way. I mean, I do feel like Glenn Close is in a situation where there's so many other really strong contenders that feels like it's factoring in a little bit to why people are backing off that narrative a bit. And I don't think supporting actress is like replete with people who have like either the quite the same level of performance as what we see in the lead category or these kind of compelling narratives about their candidacy.
Yeah.
And I think the world is like a little more full of people who remember how much they love The Master than people who were like, ooh, The Natural, ooh, that was such a good one. You know, like that Glenn Close's do-ness is a little, you know, stretches a little further back.
But, yeah.
But I am kind of surprised that well, I don't know. I guess we don't know until some of the other awards start coming in. But maybe she, you know, sometimes these like front runners start looking like they've lost all this ground at this critical
moment.
Like Gary
Oldman last year.
And yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, all will be revealed on Golden Globes night. Whoever wins there is going to win every other award after it. That's
well,
always happens.
No, not necessarily. No, I don't think so because I think there's no way in any situation where Lady Gaga can lose the Globe. She is so quintessentially a Globe person. So I think even if she doesn't win, even if she wins Best Actress at the Globe, I don't think it's sewn up for the Oscar. She might win the Oscar. But I think she just, there's just no way she can lose the Globe. That's my feeling, at least.
Yeah. But anyway,
what?
I have to think about that. I'm not prepared to respond in this moment.
So, but maybe it's just because I have too long of a memory because I remember those glorious years where there would sometimes be lots of differences from the Globes to the Oscars. Like 2004, for example.
Yeah. I mean, the last Best Actress who hasn't won either of the two Globes categories was Halle Berry, and that's 16 years ago.
Oh, okay, wow.
All right, Emily Blunt.
What?
I said, all right, Emily Blunt. She just perked up.
She did. But she might lose to Olivia Colman. Who knows? Maybe that's our winner.
That bit player, Olivia Colman.
That's that supporting actress in the story about Queen Anne.
Went to the bathroom and I missed her whole performance.
Olivia. Oh, she's so cute. I love her.
Yeah, she's great. Oh, but I was going to say, and this is me stretching my wanting Glenn Close to win thing probably too far into disbelief, but part of me thinks the Glenn Close narrative could still work because there are so many good performances.
Mm.
Like, something's got to give you the edge.
Yeah, and her narrative is the edge. Yeah.
Whereas, like, Gaga's narrative gets thrown by that obvious win for best song.
Uh-huh.
You know, to reward her for A Star Is Born.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know.
What's Olivia Colman's narrative? It's just a great actress finally being recognized. Somebody people have loved for years and now there's a chance to recognize her. Is that her narrative?
I'm not sure that she has one yet, so Fox Searchlight better get on that. Because even though, like, her fans have loved her for years, I would still argue she's a little unknown as far as the American industry goes. Like, most of her big successes are BBC stuff.
Mm-hmm. Or is that narrative Emily Blunt's? Because she's very popular, and obviously the industry has loved for years, just by the fact that she gets cast in all these big movies all the time. So,
and it would be a nice parallel. Both Mary Poppins winning the Oscar.
Yeah.
And she gave that little Easter egg performance in A Quiet Place. Like, there's this one scene that if you look really carefully, there's Emily Blunt. And you're like, oh, supporting.
she is a supporting player.
I love that, Nick, you make me have a better sense of humor about category fraud, because otherwise it would make me absolutely be institutionalized.
I'm just trying to get you through, babe.
Thank you.
Because, you're going to, like, lose your mind, because it is something that, you know, we can't control, unfortunately. It's just going to happen.
I just will never understand why everybody else buys into it. It's like, It makes me lose. I hate losing. I actually love people. I don't know if you guys know this about me, but this is one of those things that makes me lose respect for people that I would otherwise really respect because I like their writing or whatever. But it's if they buy into these insanity of like the protagonist is not really the protagonist because they have the same genitals as this other person they're acting opposite. I can't.
I have to say, like, category fraud this year unfortunately meant that Best Supporting Actress, to Nick's points earlier, kind of boring because it's basically Amy versus Regina, and yeah. Because Rachel and Emma are taking two
like,
spots.
Rachel and Emma can't win, but they're both obviously going to get nominated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would ask
Nathaniel, if this is in your, like, dating site profile, where you're like, people who think Rooney Mara was supporting can just move on. Don't...
A two-part questionnaire. Is Carol the best movie of the decade? If you answered yes, the next question comes out. Is Rooney Mara supporting? So you can make it through the first question and still be nixed. No dates for you.
It's like the end of The Last Crusade. It's just like a...
I think you need to change your questionnaire. That was so 3 years ago. Your question now is, who is the protagonist of The Favorite?
I'm pleased that you've moved on from that, Murtada, but a lot of us are still experiencing a traumatic trigger.
I'm just trying to keep us all current. That's what we need to do with the podcast. It's all about this year.
It's Christmas time. Carol is current.
That's true. Carol
is only the greatest Christmas movie of all time.
I think it's just the greatest movie of all time.
All right, well, thanks for tuning in, everyone. Next week, I don't know what we'll talk about, but I'm sure there's something coming out, because it's been like 2 weeks of nothing coming out.
We're going to talk about Julia, because Nick will have to go see Julia Roberts.
But will it be in Chicago by then?
It opens on Friday, but grades are due Monday, so no promises coming from over here, but I'll try.
Julia will judge you if you don't show
Fine.
Up.
Fine. I've already invited that.
All right.
She'll only judge me if I go to Mary Queen of Scots instead.
Well, we'll judge you for that, too.
Fair. All right.
All right.
Listeners, leave us some questions if you want us to talk about them next week.
We always welcome questions. And last time you barely asked, what was that about? We know you're listening. We can see that you're listening, so ask some questions.
This will help. Shame that.
Hey, it seems it's what the internet's about now, is shaming.
Yes. You can also ask us on Twitter.
That's true, if that's easier for you.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for listening to The Film Experience. I'm your host, Nathaniel. And thank you to Murtada Alfadl.
Thanks, everyone.
And Nick Davis.
If you tweet me, I'll tell you which scene in A Quiet Place Emily Blunt is in.
Ha ha.